everybody. This is John Conrath. I'm the editor of Air in the Paragraph Line, and we're doing this call to talk to some of the authors that participated in issue 13, which is our bad luck issue, which is now out. Just a reminder that you can always go to paragraphline.com and check out all the previous issues and who's in the current one and all of our news and everything like that. See, how can we do this? Let's go around and just do some short introductions from each of us, and we'll go from there. Tim, you want to go ahead and start?
Yes, this is Timothy Gager. I've been in the Paragraph Line, issue number 9 and issue number 13, and I'm pleased to be on the air with you, John.
And you're calling in from Boston?
I'm calling in from Boston, Massachusetts. So it's 11 o'clock Boston time, and a man barely alive.
And Ben, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure, thanks. Ben Mack, this is the first Air in the Paragraph. Glad to be here and excited to be included in the book. Thank you, John.
Okay, who else do we have online?
Aaron and David are on with you. John, I can read the dashboard if you have questions and stuff.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm Aaron. I'm Aaron Carnes. I'm in this issue 13. This is the first issue I'm in. Calling from San Jose, California.
Didn't you have a gig tonight or something like that?
I had a gig last night. Yeah, I have a band called Gnar Boots. We played in a Blank Club in San Jose.
Cool. So I'm also in Oakland, so we're the West Coast contingent as of yet.
Oh, yeah, we're playing, I can't remember where, we're playing in Oakland next Friday, a week from Friday, so you should come out.
Cool.
Hey, I'm Fiona Helmsley. I'm calling, too. This is so weird. I feel like I'm on, like, a group party line or something.
You're no relation to Leona Helmsley, are you?
No, but my name is, that's sort of the point. No, it's kind of
a
take on that a little bit, or a lot bit.
Cool. Who else is left?
That might be it.
That's it?
How lonely.
We have to identify ourselves we have to identify ourselves by name every time we talk.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with this kind of technology. I mean, party lines, yes, I am.
But. Like the lonely people friends line.
Yeah,
hey,
I guess so.
Hey, you want to go get a soda sometime? Later, creep.
You're not uptight, are you? Cool.
What are you
wearing? So who has actually gotten copies of 13 already?
I have.
I haven't yet.
I haven't yet.
I think it looks great. I was super duper impressed. Not that I was expecting any less, but I was still very, very, very impressed. It looks great. And everybody who I've shown it to also thinks that it looks really great.
I really, I like actually the list of authors in 13. I've met many of them, and I know a lot of their work. I mean, I know Nathan Graziano and Daniel Crocker. I've met and read with each of them. And it was pretty cool to be included. And John Shepherd, too, of course. So it was very, very cool to kind of be included in an anthology with people you know and people that, you know, you like and that you've heard of.
Yeah, John couldn't make it tonight because he wakes up about an hour from now. So, well, maybe a couple hours from now. But yeah. So the cover art this time, I think Kurt Eisenlohr did, which he was actually slated to do the artwork for 12, and just through some confusion and so forth, he got bumped from 12, and we went with somebody else who also did a pretty cool cover and interior art. But artwork is always the hardest part for me because I always want to get something that matches up with the theme or the stories inside, and it's usually like the last thing that happens. because this time, even just getting the layout of the cover done was something. It was the very last thing that I had to do before the book got submitted. So somebody else actually did the layout for me this time, because this is a first run on the new publisher, and they were a little more of a stickler about the way the cover art got submitted. But it turned out, looks good. And
was
I'm happy
Marie
with it.
The person that did the layout? Is that what you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, actually, Marie yeah. Mundaka, she's done a lot of, I mean, that's what she does for a living. She does more interior layouts, but she's done, like, a couple of David Foster Wallace books and a lot of stuff for Random House.
Yeah, I've had some contact with her in the past. She actually would send me, well, she did in the past a while ago. She sent me a few books before they came out. It was pretty cool. David Sedaris book and, God, I can't remember the other one. It was another woman, but, yeah, she's a cool chick, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice looking cover. I like the artwork on it. This is Aaron's name right now.
So, to open up an argument, I guess, would be to kind of ask what people's opinions were on the Kindle, and this is the first issue we've done on a Kindle. If anybody else has had experience with it, or if they kind of think it's a fraud, or what the general consensus is on that.
Well, I kind of like the Kindle. I mean, I don't think it replaces books. People are still going to always read books, but I think the Kindle's a nice option to have. One thing I don't like about it, and the same thing I don't like about music and MP3s, is if the technology becomes obsolete, what do you do with all your downloads?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, you're kind of locking yourself into their format. And, yeah, if you move somewhere else or your favorite author gets a deal with Barnes & Noble only or something like that, it was a pretty easy process to publish there. And I guess some people have had some luck just because, you know, they give a decent cut. And the big problem is just, you know, like doing any of these things is just advertising and promoting it.
So Amazon offers a decent cut with a Kindle because on my books I get about a penny, maybe less. Sometimes I lose a penny for each sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kindle doesn't interest me at all. I'll never go that way. I'm like a collector. I like to hold on. It may not be environmentally sound, or maybe for the future it won't be, a very sound way to go, but I like to hold on to my books.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing about the Kindle is if you're reading a real shitty book on Kindle and you plug it in, you can just sit in the bathtub and throw it in with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not very interested as well in reading on a Kindle, although I'm not opposed to the technology or I don't feel threatened by it. I just don't personally – I personally like holding books too. But, yeah, I don't think it's going to ruin or have any problems. I think it will only help sales overall. Of books.
I'm grateful that they give a higher percentage to the publisher and authors, and I'm grateful that it brings down the price point so more people can afford to get our awards.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the publication. Go ahead.
I think also, though, I mean, Kindle's been accused and Amazon's been accused of the whole price fixing on the Kindles. I mean, it shouldn't be like $14 to $16 to download a book onto a Kindle. I think that part of it is kind of ridiculous.
Well, that'll take exception, too. I mean, who the heck is anybody to say what the price of information or our words should or shouldn't be? I mean, I happen to hold that whatever we can get for our words, we're entitled to get. If we could sell a book for $3,000 on a Kindle, you know, I'd go yay to that author. Well done.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there, but there's also a whole school of big press versus small press, and the big press is always scared of new technology that is going to jump in and steal their audience. So they want to keep the prices up because if the technology can bring the prices down, they're worried about their lost sales. And it's sales versus art, and
Yeah, and the price fixing stuff is always, you know, it's like I think Macmillan was the first one that got a lot of press, and you know, kind of the bigger ones are the ones that want the higher price points. But I mean, it seems like, yeah, the independent authors are the ones that are selling stuff at, you know, $1 or $2 or whatever, and aren't afraid to go for the lower price point.
I mean, the difference between a $14.99 Kindle download and, you know, the Air and Paragraph line book, which is $1.99 on Kindle, I mean, that's very drastic. So, I mean, right away, it's kind of a red flag.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm grateful for the pressure it puts on the big publishers.
Yeah. My take on the whole Kindle is I like the fact that, I mean, the problem with doing the paper publishing stuff has always been there's always a minimum price because you're paying for, you know, the printing and the dead trees. And, like, even when we started doing print on demand, it was a big thing because we didn't have to invest thousands of dollars and have a garage full of books. You know, we could do a very minimal investment. And now the Kindle is even lower than that. It's like the way HTML was when it first came out. You're basically, you know, it's just electrons. You don't have to worry about that. But, yeah, the flip side of it is I really do like to hold a book in my hands and have that physical book. Like,
Vonnegut
used to...
And you can give it to your friends. And,
yeah.
You know.
Vonnegut,
I mean,
used to
get
do
on
a whole
the
thing.
Kindle,
yeah. But Kurt Vonnegut used to always talk about that, about just the fact that when you have a print book in your hands, it's like it almost hypnotizes you, you know, gives you... It takes you into the story, and you know.
Well, when you're like sitting up, when you're sitting on the subway and you see what somebody else is reading, I mean, it's. I guess you could look over their Kindle, but. And then what about in the future, like, post-apocalypse, the next generation of beings who come around and find our artifacts? I mean, you know what a. They're going to need batteries for the Kindles that they find. I mean, a book they could. You know, a book tells our story generations from now. A Kindle, you're going to have to find batteries to tell a story. So.
Yeah. Yeah, a paper book is much more intimate, or it feels much more intimate. I mean, you can, like, you can hang out with it. You can carry it around. You can take it to bed. You take a Kindle to bed, it's like, you know, a sex robot or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, but who's to say? I mean,
not that I use them.
I don't have gotten a Kindle yet, but I always feel kind of slow to move on to technology, but then I just kind of go with it. So maybe I'll get a Kindle someday and just love it.
Well, if they can put porn on it, I think I'll buy one, but I can get that on my watch right now. So.
Wow.
Yeah, I like, we've always made the previous issues available for free for download, and I've always been kind of wondering who actually reads the stuff on their computer or not versus reading the paper, you know, the actual paper book. But it's good to have the option there. But
yeah, I like
of course,
the free downloads just for an option for people because I think it allows people to browse. I don't know if people can really read hundreds of pages on their computer. I'm sure there are, but that's kind of not for me. But it's really, really good for me to browse things and see if I, you know, would like something.
Yeah, how come you didn't make the Kindle for free?
You can't actually anymore.
Oh, really?
When it first came out, you did have the ability to do it for free, but now I think you can set it for like a penny.
Penny.
But yeah, there were a couple other books that I saw there kind of at that price point, and it was an experiment to see how many people would actually buy it or not, and I don't know if I'm going to lower the price in the future and see. And we haven't had a ton of hits on it yet. I think everybody pretty much wants the paper version.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, if it was free, I would probably just put it on there like a little bit after the paper one came out, kind of as a loss leader. But it's also having the PDFs online has been cool because now Google will index PDFs and, like, you find people that are – when I go through weblogs that are doing searches on just, like, weird crap and, you know, run into a story that's been in a previous issue. So that's always cool when that happens. I don't know if they actually stay and read or if they were, you know, looking for free Viagra or what, but, you know.
The strangest search that someone found one of the stories, John.
I'd have to go back and look, but I mean, you know, people are always like searching for like just like pictures of, you know, sex with sheep or just like weird stuff like that, that for whatever reason, like the magic three words are in a row and, you know, one of my stories or somebody else's and it trips the search. But, yeah, I was actually, I should probably mine all those out and just make a web page of all the searches that people have ended up on the website with.
Yeah.
So what have been other people's publishing experience in the past? I know a couple of you have been had, you know, I know, Tim, you've got a ton of stuff out, but what's been other people's experiences?
Me? I've come from, like, a zine world. I mean, everything that I've done myself up until when I started putting my writing up on websites was stuff that I self-published. You know, like I said, I've done different zines at times, not for a long time. I mean, I'm 33 now, but when I was much younger. You know, and then I would send those zines into places to get reviewed, and then, or like Maximum Rock and Roll, and people would order them that way. But, you know, I mean, that's still basically my experience. Right now I'm working on an anthology with another woman, and she wants to do that. I almost said major label. She wants to take that to, she wants that to be on a big imprint. I would have no problem with doing it through an on-demand site, but she wants to do it with big press. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
But my
That's cool.
experience has been a DIY.
Yeah, I think most of us have come from zine experience at some point, or at least those of us who were around in the 90s doing all the photocopier zines and the punk stuff and everything else. I mean, that was a big part of the reason that I got into this was I used to do a heavy metal zine and that kind of dried out. I still wanted to do something, so I turned to this.
Well, that's what I think is so great with like sites like Lulu and Blurb. It's still pretty cheap. Well, it's very cheap, and it's, you know, it's a good avenue to get your stuff out there. You know.
Yeah, Aaron, didn't you do a book on Lulu too?
Yeah, I did. I did it a while ago. I thought like a lot of the stories are older. Actually, the story in this issue is from that, although I had rewritten it before it got published, so it's a little different. But it was interesting, and it was cool to like make a book. But I ultimately feel like it was I didn't really think it was like the strongest thing, or at least at this point, I don't feel like it's the strongest thing compared to what I've been writing lately, so I don't like really put much push on it, I guess.
Well, the
but
advantage,
I did that.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah, I said the advantage of that though is if you're putting it out on Lulu, can't you pull it off yourself?
Like, yeah, I've been contemplating that, but I haven't like made a decision yet. But then I've been trying to go the route of like sending stories to zines bigger and smaller just to try to get some just to see what people will publish and stuff, and I've gotten a few published in smaller places and stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
By the way, if any of you ever any of you authors ever have anything that you're pimping out, zine appearances or anything like that, please feel free to mail them in. I'm always struggling to find stuff to post on our blog, and I definitely will post pointers back, because that's kind of one of the hopes, is that people will read about, you know, read some of these other writers in the book and you know, go out and hunt down their stuff in other places.
I mean, I've got a blog that's basically just a news blog, and I post anytime I'm published out somewhere. In March I've been published in 5 places, so usually every day there's something to put up. So if you want to grab stuff on that, or I can send you links for that, John, it'd be really appreciated.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a big struggle too, is always trying to keep up with writers, finding out. I mean, I guess Facebook is, you know, I think everybody here is doing some stuff on Facebook, but what are
it's
other
hard.
Places people?
Yeah. It's hard.
Other,
and, I mean, other places.
You said it was hard?
Yeah, it's difficult because, I mean, you want to be a good promoter. You want to get your stuff out, but there's not a whole lot of original promoting you can do. And I always feel that annoying my friends by pointing things out. So I try to point out subtly, like, I mean, Facebook is great for things like that. And Facebook is actually really, really good if you're out doing appearances a lot or you're doing readings. So you can hook in locally. I travel a lot when I read. So, like, I'll be, like, in different cities coming up, and it's always good to try to hook up with people and expand your network that way. I mean, that's a good promotional tool. I think it's one of the better ones. Just getting published, getting other work published as many places as you possibly can, and people will look for you, and they will buy your books, and they will look for your other stuff. I mean, I've got people that every time I put something up, it's the same group of people. They always read it. They always email me, and they comment on it, and it's great stuff. You know, it's nice to be read.
Yeah.
It is great to be read. I probably have approached my writing from a different direction of most others on this call, in the sense of been a marketer and of orchestrated the marketing into the distribution, into the promoting of it. So, like, when I had a book on Lulu called Poker Without Cards, we did a marketing strategy with it that was similar to, like, the Blair Witch Project of taking the book extraordinarily seriously and stoking fires online and getting people into these little drama queen frenzy type stuff. And that drove sales of the book. It was on Lulu when it was up in 2005. I got it down to the 68th bestseller on Lulu at the time. And it was a big part of that was working with this guy named Joseph Matheny on creating that marketing plan and figuring out which fires we could ignite where and then trying to introduce the different fires to each other. And I used some marketing techniques back then that I wouldn't use again because I view some of them as toxic. But one of the great things was getting two separate populations talking about something and trying to get those two different populations to fight with each other and be talking about my book.
So the flame wars for sales.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, a circus. We viewed it as a circus, and I would go into forums in 05 with, you know, 3 to 5 avatars and get them talking and try and get, you know, 1 or 2 people within that community engaged. And then 2 of my avatars would start fighting with each other, and I'd try and get real people in there fighting. And then it was considered a success in my mind back then when I could pull out all my avatars and still have that population buzzing.
Is that book still on Lulu, or did you pull it back?
I didn't pull it. Dave, I can't pronounce his last name, the author of This Is Not a Game, he was actually the publisher of it. He passed away last year. And he had pulled it a few years back because that book had actually impacted his ability to get some corporate clients and stuff. So, and I've certainly had that experience of my writing making it so that, you know, changing what business opportunities are open to me.
What the hell do you write about?
Largely about marketing and culture, but it's like in 2004 I had an online success with a book called What Would Bill Hicks Say? And I simply put up a website.
I have a copy of that book.
Awesome. Yeah. It was better online than it was as a book, partially because unfortunately the assistant publisher who's put on it never really bought in. I don't need to get into what went wrong with the publishing thing, but at the time we got 300,000 unique visitors to a website with less than $100 in marketing because we didn't have a book idea. That's the only time in my life when a publisher's come to me. I happened to have created a website that got some buzz, and then a publisher came and said, "Hey, can we turn this into a book?" But the biggest publishing success I had was a very orchestrated launch for a business book called Two Products Ahead. And it got to be the, it was the number one business book on Amazon, but it was the number two book on Amazon overall for 3 days and 16 hours. Not that I wasn't clicking the thing and looking. Unfortunately,
so that's incredible.
2 days. Thank you. 2 days before we launched it, a new Harry Potter book came out, and you know we couldn't jump the shark. You know we were number two. We held on to number two for 3 days and 16 hours, but couldn't crack number one. But the part of how we published that was that people that purchased that book then got a interview that I did with this guy Mark Joyner, and we had incentives built in. Both to incentivize people to promote us, as well as incentivizing buyers to talk about us, and the book launch process was through looking at, you know, 8 ways from Sunday, how can we incentivize everyone that touches the book to go out and share it with others. And my biggest screw up there was naming was the subtitle. Secrets the big ad agencies don't want you to know and how to use them for bigger profits. What just didn't dawn on me, and I wished that my publisher at Wiley had thought about this, but because I was openly bashing of big media in the subtitle, newspapers wouldn't cover it. So the only newspaper that covered it was a D.C. paper that had to report it because each week they put the top 10 books on Amazon. And I was the number eight book, seven or eight, I think eight. I was the number eight book on Amazon for the week. But the stuff about, like, what do I write about that's that controversial, for me it's not that controversial. I joke with my friends that you know, compared to my square friends, I'm the hippest person they know, and compared to my hippest friends, I'm the squarest friend that they tolerate. But with What Would Bill Hicks Say, and working at an ad agency in Tampa, Florida, where our primary client was Publix, that's owned and run by a puritanical family, and back then they were heavy supporters of Bush, they weren't okay with having the lead strategist of their advertising being openly, you know, seeking to disempower Bush. That just wasn't okay with them. So it goes. I guess that's another Vonnegut reference. So it goes.
Yeah, there you go. So have you, has anybody figured out what Amazon's ranking system, how it works? Because I was actually, I think last Friday, reloading the page, trying to see where the numbers were going on the book.
It's a secret formula. It's like the quarterback rankings. I believe it has to do with, like, weekly sales versus a more fluid sale within, like,
yep,
certain periods, and then they take the average of those and then they give it the ranking.
Yep.
So if you sell a lot of books in a short period of time, your ranking will jump much quicker than the total number of book sales against the mass.
Exactly.
I know in 2002 or 3, I had a book on Lulu and on Barnes & Noble's numbers. I bought three or four books two or three times in a row, and because the book had been on for such a short period of time and had so many sales, it immediately jumped like to 44 and then to 12 and then back down to, you know, 63,000. But,
and you ran out of money.
Yeah, but for about 5 minutes it was at number 12, and then it vanished back down. But I got a screenshot of it there, so that's good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's a good plot.
Yeah, number 13 didn't go that high. I think it was in the, I think they were in the mid-5,000s on Friday afternoon, but then jumped back down.
Yeah, well, it's very strange, too, based on, like, ratings and how they work, and things very similar to what John was saying. A lot of people promote their books as if, like, you know, buy this book as a favor to me. And the bottom line is people should buy you because they want to buy your book. You know, like,
yeah,
hey, you buy my book, I'll buy your book, we'll do it at this time, the rankings will jump. It's like, well, maybe, you know, don't do me any favors by buying my book if you don't want to read it, you know.
I like that perspective. Don't do me any favors. Buy my book if you're going to read it. But, yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. I think one of my hopes in having so many different authors was that somebody would buy the book because, like, one of the people in it was somebody that they really wanted to read, and then they would, you know, in turn end up reading somebody else's stuff and get turned on to that. Like, back in the old days, SST Records used to put out those compilations for, like, $2. And you'd buy it because there was, like, a Black Flag song on it, and then you'd listen to it, and you'd hear some band you never heard of before and start buying their stuff.
Yeah, Twin Tone did the same thing.
Yeah, and it's definitely, and I think, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, I have to read all these stories because I have to put them in there, and I have to read the ones that don't make it, too, but I think I've ended up meeting a few other writers that have had good stuff and then have gone out and bought their books or, you know, read stuff that they appeared in. And, you know, I've found some pretty good stuff that way.
You should have gotten Henry Rollins in there, and you'd have your Black Flag reference. And
yeah.
Maybe you could go on IFC or something.
Yeah. Does he still have that show on IFC? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know if they're repeats now. But, yeah, it's still on. But they could be. They're probably repeats.
You know, we've got 17 people listening live online and one person who called in. And for all those people that are here, I do want to encourage them to, on the page, you'll see on the left-hand side, it says reviews on Amazon. And that's actually takes you straight to Amazon where you can either buy the bound copy or buy the Kindle version for only $1.99. And John, pardon me for butting in with a promotion for people to actually open up their wallet, take out their credit card, and enter in the digits to get our words in their home. But I'm going to shamelessly pimp that one more time. On the left side of the screen where it says reviews on Amazon, you can click that and it takes you to the page.
Yeah, and if all 13 people do it at once, think of our ranking.
And none of that money is going to any charity. I just had to clear that up.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless there's an earthquake here, then, you know, which, you know, is a possibility. But, yeah, then we'll start a charity for that, too. But, yeah, and I should also point people to go to paragraphline.com just in general because there are links there to go check out the book and to read some of the past ones. And we also have there's a contributors page that has bios for each of the people that have been in this issue and in some of the past issues too. So there's a lot of links there to blogs and books and publishing companies and stuff. So a lot of reading to be done there.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear some of the folks here that I'm talking to hear about their stories since I don't have a copy of the book yet.
Me too.
Yeah, maybe we can go around the horn and each person can talk a little bit about their story or kind of where it came from.
All right. Do you want me to start? I can start.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my story is called Joe the Salamander. And Joe the Salamander is actually written 5 or 6 years ago when I was writing longer work. Right now, the stories that I write tend to be 500 words or less, maybe 1,000 here and there, but Joe the Salamander is a longer work, and it's about basically a guy who feels uncomfortable in his own skin, and, you know, I don't diagnose him, I don't give him any labels, I don't give him anything of that sort, but eventually he finds his security in a salamander's costume, but unfortunately it's he's wearing it when the Salamander Festival is going on in Arizona. All kinds of hijinks occurs, including a Super Salad promotion where another guy in a salamander's kind of run into each other. So that's the brief synopsis of Joe the Salamander.
How did you get permission to use Super Salad?
You know what? You're allowed to. There's always that... There's always a debate online, you know, can I use Coca-Cola? Can I use this? If you're not saying, like, Super Salad sucks or I found a worm in my salad every time I go there, I mean, they don't really care. You're using it as a reference. You're not using it to make any profit. No one's going to buy Air in the Paragraph line because they heard Super Salad's in it.
Tim, I was just reading your bio in the back, and it says, Timothy has been nominated for 8 Pushcart Awards and has won 0.
Yeah, it's sad. I was hoping to get, like, a pity vote.
Funny you put that in there.
Well, the thing is, a lot of people get nominated, and it's always in the bios, and it's a great thing. and it's really great because the people that published you nominated you. But there's very often, though, there's a lot of, you know, nominations. People can nominate themselves, actually, for a Pushcart. So it's sort of each Pushcart nomination you got to really look at and diagnose to see, you know, is it something? I mean, I'm proud of my 8. I've gotten
definitely.
I've gotten nominated from, like, Night Train and some really, really strong places. And there are other places that, like, I've actually emailed and said, look, you guys are a small place. Have you ever considered a Pushcart nomination? And consider me because you published me. And I actually got a couple that way, too. So.
Yeah.
So, I want to hear about your story, Fiona.
My story is, sometimes I have a hard time with titles, and I remember, John, you said that maybe I should think about a different title. It had been up on Cherry Bleeds a few years ago. It's an older story, and there it was just listed as Smoking Struggles, which was a cop-out on my part, but John said that I should jazz it up, so I went with, that line from Brokeback Mountain, I wish I could quit you, so I went with that, and it's about smoking. And I remember when I wrote it a few years ago, it was initially I wrote it based on, like, just this very clear memory I had of where it starts when I'm at this girl's house when I'm 13, the first time I ever smoked a cigarette. And it's actually funny because I used the girl's name in the story, and when it was up on Cherry Bleeds, which actually in my bio they had my email address, she emailed me. And she was like, you know, I Googled myself, and your story came up. So it, you know, got me back in contact with this girl who I hadn't talked to since I was about 13. But anyway, it's just about my trials and tribulations as a stinky smoker. And I actually don't kind of like the ending of it. I don't like the way it's two stories that I combined with the theme of smoking. And mostly I write creative nonfiction, more memoir, and the ending of the story where I bring in this character, Thaddeus Robbery. He's more of a device that I've used him in some other stories that I've written, and he more represents, for a period of time in my 20s, I was kind of, for lack of a better term, I was a groupie. And he kind of represented, like I mentioned before, with the Maxim Rock and Roll, I was really into punk rock. And his character kind of represents just the older, you know, punk, past their prime punk guys that I used to kind of glom onto. So that story, the ending of that story is more fiction than I usually go. But, I kind of lost my train of thought there. It's a great story. You should read it.
Cool.
So, this is Aaron. My story is called Killing Time on Planet Earth. It's about a couple who are basically barely surviving, and then they're visited by an old friend who's kind of a big rock star now. And he wants to, like, slum with them, and they go get some drugs, and the drugs end up killing him, and it opens up this, like, Pandora's box, like, conspiracy theory, or, like, all these giant authorities come down and are chasing down the couple, and they're not really sure why, and they don't feel like they did anything, but the authorities are treating them as if they were responsible for it and stuff. It's kind of it's kind of like a little surreal, borderline sci-fi, but kind of not really traditional sci-fi.
Kind of a little bit of a David Lynch kind of twist to it a little bit.
Yeah. That mine too is a number of years old. Like, it sounds like everybody else's. I was in my self-published book. I thought it was actually the strongest story of that series. So I was a lot more interested in the surreal element and stories back then, which I've kind of moved away from somewhat. And I feel like a little more broad in my writing now.
I have a lot of broads in mind too. Sorry, that was very misogynistic, but it was a good plan of words. Maybe John, why don't you tell us some of the other stories that really you liked in this issue?
I liked a lot of the stories. I mean, I liked both of mine, of course, but John Shepherd.
Yours too.
Oh yeah. Well, I had two stories in this one, and I kind of have two different styles of writing, and it represents both. And the one, Burial Ground, is a story that has been kicking around for about 10 years, and it's written about when I was in school in Bloomington, and it just kind of goes over a bad breakup and kind of a bad turn of luck for the character. And then the other story that I had called, it's My Friend the Jihadist, and this is kind of based, this is the kind of writing I like to do a little more, and it's more like the book Rumored to Exist that I wrote. So it's a little more twisted and kind of a little more absurdist, which is actually, it's kind of based on something that actually happened, which is that I used to publish this heavy metal magazine and in the 90s, and this dude used to send me record reviews for Slayer albums or whatever, death metal albums. And then I didn't hear from him for a really long time. And then in 2004, I came home and I had 20 phone messages. And they were from all these newspapers and from the FBI. And it turns out that this guy was that guy, Adam Gadan, who's the Al-Qaeda operative now. And the only hit on Google was my old zine. And he got put on the FBI top list. And all of a sudden, I'm getting all these calls from Fox News and CNN and all this crap. And it ended up turning into a cover story on the New Yorker, not me specifically, but the guy that wrote about it interviewed me. So I kind of wanted to take that experience of having a old friend turn up into something else and, explode it into a big story. So I kind of took that and stood it on its end. Unfortunately, that didn't sell any extra copies of the books or back catalog or anything like that, but it was kind of an interesting
thing. Wow, that's
thing.
Fascinating. I read the news that the name doesn't sound familiar. What happened to him?
He's still around. I mean, he's still hanging out in a cave somewhere,
presumably. Oh, he's still in Afghanistan or...
Yeah, or Pakistan or something
Pakistan.
Like that, yeah. Yeah, he's still around. He's in all of those videos that they do. But,
they have him speak because he's American.
Yeah, get him on YouTube to promote the book.
Tell him you'll send him some Slayer.
Yeah, I mean, they always have to hold up a copy of a newspaper to prove that it's a recent film.
Yeah.
So, they could just hold up the book. But, as far as other stories that I liked or that I kind of connected with, I liked John Shepherd's story about when he was a kid building a house with his dad and his brother, partially because I went to Florida and visited John a few years ago, and he took me around Sarasota and kind of showed me all of the locations that were in his book, Small Town Punk, and he took me to that house, which somebody else lives there now, but he showed it to me. So it's kind of funny to see that in print format.
John writes about that house a lot.
Yeah, he comes back to some of the same characters and the same kind of events from Sarasota, and I kind of like that when he does that. But, yeah, both of his stories were good, but I think that that one kind of resonates just because I actually stood in front of that house and saw it, and it is kind of a screwed-up house. But
it doesn't have a right angle in it, does it?
No, it's it looks like it was, you know, built with a broken level or something like that. Yeah, so I like that story a lot. Both of Keith Buckley's stories were good. He's got kind of a kind of style that I like. I'm a big fan of, like, Mark Lehner's stuff from back in the day, and he kind of writes similar to that. And Keith's somebody that I don't think I've ever met him in person, but we've talked in email for probably almost 20 years. He's a faculty or staff member at the school I went to, and he's a librarian, actually, but he's been knocking back and forth stories for a while, and he's kind of been on a tear recently. He has a blog on LiveJournal. He's been posting stuff. And I think probably one of my other really favorite ones, I mean, aside from all the ones we've already talked about, of course, but Todd Taylor, who's also known as Motel Todd, has a story called Banjo Alien Zen. And once again, it's like this kind of bizarro take on just kind of this guy that's dropped out of society and is living in his mom's garage, and kind of his head gets infected by aliens, and kind of gets off on this evangelical kick. Todd's stuff is always pretty interesting, and I think that recently he's been taking more of that kind of bizarre trail, and I always like that kind of stuff.
So while we've been on the phone, Aaron just friended me on Facebook, which is a cool thing, technology.
Well, multitasking.
Yeah.
We're discussing, people are discussing what we're talking about on wall.
And in fact, if folks want to click again on one of the buttons on the left, the one that says promote us on Twitter, if you've got a Twitter account, you click that button, it'll give folks a link so that they can listen in live to the end of this conversation or listen to the replay, because the replay will begin immediately following our call.
How does the replay work, by the way? Is that is it a streaming thing, or can people download it, or how does that?
They can, either way. They can stream it or download an MP3.
Okay, so they can throw it on their iPod and listen to it while they're jogging.
Hey, guys.
Yep.
Do y'all hear
this
me?
Just in, yeah. Someone just wrote to me and said there's probably porn on the Kindle already, come to think about it. Sales just went up.
The article. I write more articles than I write fiction, and the work of fiction of mine that's in line 13 is called Zagarnik, which is named after Bloom Zagarnik. Bloom Zagarnik was a psychologist who noticed that waiters and waitresses in restaurants can remember a huge order with, you know, 18, 20 people, but 5 minutes after they've delivered the order, they don't remember who had what. And marketers, especially direct response marketers, have been using what Mark Joyner coined and popularized as the Zagarnik effect, which is giving incomplete information. I don't know who's pressing their buttons, but we're getting a lot of
not me.
Pressing. Oh,
not
good.
Me.
Not me either.
And the one of the things that I can write certain articles that will get certain things covered, and there's stuff that nobody seems to care about, but I find important or striking. And I found it amazing. Right. I came across the fact that William S. Burroughs, his uncle, was Ivy Lee. And Ivy Lee was the guy who invented the press release, which really allowed a lot of modern media to exist, in the sense of you don't have to tell your story to each person. A corporation or whatever could print out the story that they wanted the news, and the news would then be good little shepherds and print the story the way that they were supposed to.
Well,
and
that's really interesting if you think about it, the press release and the typewriter. His family was typewriter family, too.
I didn't know that.
That's
awesome.
Insane.
Yeah.
Well, they were mechanical, like adding machines.
Or the adding machine, that's what it was, the adding machine, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm.
But his take on mass media in so many ways, I mean, had to be influenced by, you know, family events and stuff and Uncle Ivy and talking about how he's controlling the masses for the interests of large corporations and stuff along those lines. And there are many times when I've known how certain media things work, and I'll share that, and someone will say, that's incredible, meaning that they don't believe me. And for me, a story like Zagarnik is a way to weave in some ideas that that I think are neat and important, but they go down easier in fiction than they do in – I haven't found a way to put those in a nonfiction article to make those spread. I've been better at getting my technical, my nonfiction ideas across into spread in fiction than I have in my nonfiction.
Wow. I guess it says something about what people are ready for or how they can handle it, you know?
I think that's a good point, Fiona. In terms of what people are ready for and what they can handle, I mean, part of what attracted me to Aaron the Paragraph is the respect for absurdism, because so much of what happens out there is completely absurd to me, and it actually feels more real to describe it in fiction than to try and point out factual inaccuracies or things along those lines. It's when things become so weird and twisted, it's easier for me to talk about them in metaphor than it is straight up many times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, everything has elements of weird and twisted.
Well, and I think also for your audience, you know, just digestion-wise, if there's a little bit of plausible deniability they can latch on to, you know.
That's right. Right. Right.
So I hope we take some phone calls soon.
I don't write much fiction at all. I mean, I can. Like, if I want to, I can. But I just tend to not want to. Hold on. My phone is going to – I like to – recreate events. Hold on, I have to. That's my phone now. Though I wasn't the person hitting the button before. Sorry.
So what did people think overall about the bad luck theme? I mean, was that a stretch for anybody? I saw a lot of interesting stuff come in, but I didn't know if. I think some people tried to explain a little bit of like, well, this isn't necessarily bad luck, but it's close. But what were people's thoughts on that?
Well, if anybody has a problem with, you know, things not fitting into that format or that theme, then they're anal, you know?
Yeah, well, I think also people already had stories prepared before a theme was named and they try to fit that in. So they're saying, hey, it's not really bad luck, you know, like not the story I sent John called The Lottery Winner, and I guess he turned that one down. But you got to understand, I think a themed issue is always kind of cool. It's always harder to get submissions to any theme because you're cutting, you know, at full cutoff. But I think, bad luck is as good a theme as any, and it's, you know, it's pretty easy prompt to write for.
Yeah, this was our third themed issue. The first one, number 10, was number 11 was our work issue. People always seem to find it easy to write about good or bad jobs, mostly bad jobs. And then we did the weird, paranoid, insane issue for 12, and then bad luck this time, which we kind of had to do for number 13. I wanted to do something special for that. And still open on what the theme for 14 is or whether we'll go back to not having a theme, because it is hard to get people to write, you know, to commission things for a specific issue, especially if it's, you know, a reprint or something that somebody's been sending out already. But it is cool to have some kind of loose connection between the stories.
Tough to come up with a theme for the number 14.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really anything with 14 that I can think of off the top of my head. But
Pete Townsend's boyfriends, you can have that as a theme. I don't know how many stories you'll get coming that way.
Yeah, that might be a little too obscure, but that's a good
one. A little
one
twisted.
Yeah.
If I come up with one, but I might be the only one. A special Pete Townsend issue.
That one might be, was it Pete Townsend that had the legal issues over a couple years ago?
He was just doing research, man. Yeah, he just was doing research.
Yeah. He was just doing research, but he held on to some of the research articles.
I like the idea of thinking about what, like, the antonym of 13 might be. Like, if 13 is bad luck, what's the antonym of bad luck? Pronoia? You know, somebody's tendency of seeing the universe is showering them with blessings or something. It's like happy paranoia or something. It's not exactly along the theme of the previous work, but.
Yeah, narcissism.
There you go.
There you go. There's a theme.
That'd be a great theme. That would be really
yeah.
good. That would be great.
So I think we're just about at the 1 hour point. We're kind of running out of steam here. So why don't we go around one more time and just to throw out where we can find you, other than, of course, you can go to paragraphline.com and see everybody's bios and check out the new issue. There's links there to Amazon. And if you're anti-Amazon, you can get the book at Barnes & Noble or any other bookseller has it out there. Online booksellers.
All right. I'd like to thank John for having us. And, you know, definitely buy your copies of Paragraph Line. And I'm Timothy Gager, and you can find me at timothygager.com.
I want to reiterate that thanks to John for producing, for editing and producing the book. And my name is Ben Mack, and you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/branding.
Go ahead first.
Oh, thank you. My name's Fiona Helmsley, and I want to thank John, too. I have a blog on MySpace. It's blogs.myspace.com, Fiona Helmsley. And I'm also doing an anthology of female writers with a writer from California named Renee Diedrich, and we are taking submissions for it from female writers. And you can email her at radaccess7@aol.com if it sounds interesting to you. And thank you, John.
Cool. Yeah, thanks a lot for this. My name is Aaron Carnes. My website is aaroncarnes.com. Information about my writing, and there's also links to information about my band. We have an album you can download for free. So that's about it.
Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody that joined in and everybody that listened to, and thanks to Ben for setting this up. I think this is kind of a new way of doing a reading and having listening to a bunch of authors talk, and that's always awesome. But anyway, you can always find me at rumor.com. Definitely paragraphline.com. The issue is on Amazon, and you know, as far as other writers, I think once I get caught up here, we'll start talking about number 14 and what's next there.
All right, cool.
Great. Good luck on you
cool.
guys.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.